Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against enemies of all kinds, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, there is reason to believe that the enemies, foreign and domestic, are on the march. And in a whole array of fronts, it, of course, gives us a lot of grist for the mill here at Securing America, even when we're on the road, as we are at the moment in our mobile studio. And when they are afoot, who better to visit with about the magnitude of the challenge we're now facing than our duty expert and genius? His name is George Raceley. He is these days the editor of Conservative HQ, a marvelous newsletter by Richard Viguerie. But he brings a wealth of experience, including his membership in the Mensa Society, but also as a man who has worked in senior positions, both in the legislative and the executive branch. Some 300 political campaigns, no less, including presidential ones. A lot of experience, a lot of insights, a lot of intellect and intelligence. And we're always delighted to catch up with George Raceley. Welcome back, sir. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. Before I did those 300 campaigns, I had hair.
Yes, you did. And we pulled it out together, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
George, I do want to start by talking about something that is, hair-raising if you had it and hair-pulling if you'd gotten rid of it. And that is Joe Biden and what we have been learning about his presidency, specifically about the degree to which he is exposed now, as what our colleague and friend at the Committee on the Present Danger, Sam Faddis, calls a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party. You've written in Conservative HQ about the extent to which it's simply inconceivable that Joe Biden didn't know what his son was up to in terms of his dealings with the Chinese Communist Party's, well, former intelligence assets, among others. And we've just been treated to a really important further piece of documentary evidence in the form of a video that a longtime friend of mine and colleague by the name of Gal Luft has provided to the New York Post, in which he lays out what he personally saw from his role as an advisor to this Chinese enterprise called CEFC, with which Joe Biden, through Hunter, was actively doing business. And it's incredibly damning stuff. Give us your read on what we know and how culpable the president of the United States is of high crimes and misdemeanors, including, I would argue, treason.
Well, you said in the beginning of this segment that the enemies of America were on the march, and I would say they're not only on the march, they've occupied the White House. Between Gal and the revelations from the Marco Polo project of the contents of Hunter Biden's laptop, which I've written extensively about, there is absolutely no way that Joe was not intimately involved with these transactions with the Communist Chinese fronts. It's worth noting that Hunter made several trips to Red China with Joe on Air Force Two, and that in the immediate aftermath of those trips, lo and behold, he gets hired for multi-million dollar do-nothing contracts.
Well, as I recall, he got $1.5 billion to invest from the Chinese Communists.
Yep. Exactly. And that's above and beyond the direct cash transactions, you know, in essence, payments. I would argue thinly disguised bribes.
And they went to great lengths to try to conceal the incoming money, right?
They ran them through various shell corporations. They transferred them to Smurfs, who are basically, you know, people who collect the money and then pass it on. All of these things, yeah, are blatant money laundering crimes. And, you know, if
it sounds like racketeering to me, and that's a high crime and misdemeanor, isn't it?
Yeah. It's exactly the same kind of stuff that organized criminal enterprise would engage in. And this was known and reported by banks, by various whistleblowers. Bank of America, as I recall, submitted
to the Treasury Department.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and you mentioned in passing there of Gal Luft's testimony, and mm-hmm. I think, you know, he's saying that he met with the Department of Justice and the FBI in 2019 to lay out this case. So they had this information for months. And the reason he says he did it was because he thought it imperative as a citizen of the United States to try to make sure that the president was not going to be a guy working for the Chinese Communist Party. And it was ignored. It was covered up. So it's just another example of really the rot here, George Raceley. And I just want to say also, we did a fantastically interesting webinar with our Committee on the Present Danger of China, of which I'm very proud you are a member, yesterday, concerning Neil Shen and Sequoia Capital. I know you haven't had a chance to look at it, but I really commend it to our audience because it's another example. And in fact, our friend Sam Faddis provided his professional judgment as a former prosecutor that here again, the evidence is so compelling of criminal conduct in the case of Shen and Sequoia of helping transfer critical technologies to our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party, making a fortune in the process. But George, it's a question, as Sam put it, is does anybody have the resolve to prosecute the case, whether it's Biden or whether it's Shen or whether it's any number of other captured elites?
Yeah, no. And that's therein lies the problem, is because this is the Red Chinese have engaged in a very sophisticated campaign of elite capture. They understand perfectly that the, you know, Harvard Law School grads are not going to prosecute each other. They understand perfectly that Hunter's Yale classmates have automatic entree and immunity. And so this is why they engage in this. This is why also, frankly, why the Bidens were such easy marks for this.
And in addition, of course, to the people trained in our elite institutions, you have people who have just gotten into positions that are useful to the Chinese, and they've been bought, usually bought. Sometimes it's, you know, sexual peccadilloes that they've exploited, right, or ideological tendencies, but mostly I think it's just rank corruption. Mm-hmm. But George, the problem is, and the bottom line of our webinar, by the way, spoiler alert, but please go to Present Danger China and check it out for yourselves, folks, is we must make a course correction on China a voting issue in 2024. Please God, we will have something approaching a free and fair election. But if it's overwhelmingly and the outcome, it may offset some of the efforts to deprive us of that. But the key piece of this, George, and I know you get it completely, as is Richard Viguerie, is we will lose our country if we don't rid ourselves of these people in positions of power and influence who are working for the other team. We have to take a short break, George. When we come back, I want to talk to you about a problematic general officer who has been nominated to head our military. Talk about that more. The other side of this break, stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. We recently published a response to the unrestricted warfare Chinese communists have long waged with help from captured elites in this country. It's called The Indictment, Prosecuting the Chinese Communist Party and Friends for Crimes Against America, China, and the World. Yesterday, that prosecution got underway in earnest. The latest webinar, sponsored by our Committee on the Present Danger China, featured two top experts and a former prosecutor who brought criminal charges in the court of public opinion against the world's most successful venture capitalist, Neil Shen, and his firm, Sequoia Capital. The evidence presented reveals they have betrayed our country by enabling the CCP to secure decisive leads in dozens of technologies that can dominate us commercially and defeat us militarily. Neil Shen and company have thus far successfully deployed bipartisan contributions to get away with such treachery. That must end now. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. Our resident genius is in the house, our friend George Raceley. We're talking with him about high crimes and misdemeanors and other terrible developments that need course correction right quick. One of them, I think, is the nomination of an Air Force general currently serving as the chief of staff of the Air Force, a man by the name of Charles, better known as CQ Brown. He is a black combat pilot. This has nothing to do with race, I'm sure, but he has been nonetheless nominated to become the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he brings with him some very troubling baggage, a distinguished flying record, yes, to be sure, but some very troubling policy notions, some of which are clearly tied to his fealty to the people who have given him successive promotions. George Raceley, you've been looking into it. You've just written a very important piece at Conservative HQ. Tell us about CQ Brown.
Well, you're right. The general does have a very admirable combat record, but he talks like the diversity dean at some elite academic institution. If you gave the diversity dean at UCLA a fighter jet to fly, you'd have General Brown in a nutshell. He's made it very clear that white people are not welcome on his promotion ladder, that he is intends on advancing people on the basis of their race. And he's not shy about it. And this is truly astonishing in a military that has come so far since it was segregated during World War II. It became, in essence, the most merit-based institution in the United States. And that is rapidly gone out the window.
Because it was merit-based, it was an enormously integrated and diverse institution. But people were promoted because they were warriors and good at what they did, not because of skin color or ethnicity or what have you. Yep. And George, what's so worrying about this is that this is a fundamental transformation of the armed forces of the United States. I call what we're in the Obama-Biden 3.0 administration. It started in earnest with Barack Obama in his first administration, of course, but it's kind of the last institution standing, and it seems rapidly to be going the way of every other in the direction the Marxists wish to take us, which is down, no?
Yeah, well, the thing about it is, Frank, is that this the attitude expressed by General Brown in his numerous comments, this was not, you know, a one-off, too much fun at the O Club type of situation. This has been many, many public statements.
And policy directives, including, as I understand it, in the Air Force, saying there's going to be a quota of white male pilots going forward. What's that about?
Well, what it's about is it's straight out of the Marxist-Leninist-Maoist playbook, in which the military is not the defender and supporter of the Constitution. It is the vanguard of social change. It's the Stalinist idea that revolution comes from above. And so,
replete with political commissars to enforce the dictates from above. No.
Yeah. Well, that's who your diversity officers are. It's the
political commissars. And they're now being insinuated at, I think, every level. But so to cut to the chase, the Senate Armed Services Committee is the committee that has the responsibility for vetting these kinds of presidential nominations to the General Officer Corps, and for that matter, you know, field grade officers as well. George Raceley, in your professional judgment, is it imperative, not just desirable, but absolutely necessary that the committee's review of this particular nomination not only take into account all the things that you've just pointed to and that are in your CQ article, but also the degree to which what is being done to the United States military is highly detrimental to its good order and discipline, its readiness, and its deterrent qualities.
Yeah, it absolutely is crucial, Frank. And no patriotic senator should vote in favor of this guy's promotion to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And, you know, he's gotten previous promotions on unanimous or nearly unanimous votes based on his combat record. But this is a completely different position. This is not leading the warfighters in a squadron or, you know, this is a policy setting position for the entire U.S. military. And we cannot afford a Marxist, race-obsessed chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Amen. George, this brings me to another topic that you touched on, and it's related, really. You talked about how the Democratic Party has now embraced essentially a program that is the very antithesis of the Declaration of Independence, whose signing we celebrated just recently. Give us a short course on that, if you would. We've got 3 minutes or so.
Well, the Declaration of Independence includes, in addition to the ringing endorsement of the right of all people to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, a list of grievances against the government then present in the colonies. And if you go through that list,
the royal
King George
in Britain,
so if you go through that list, it reads like the Democrat platform: higher taxes, right down to dragging people off to distant places for them to be prosecuted for imaginary crimes, and so it's very interesting to translate those grievances that the founding fathers had and put down in the Declaration of Independence into today's political situation. And so,
George, you know, what makes this even worse to my way of thinking, and that's plenty bad enough, needless to say, but what, as you know, we've talked about it on this program repeatedly, this administration, the Democratic Party, has embraced the idea of not only this kind of autocratic government in the United States, but wholly unaccountable foreign government running our affairs in the form of these transnational organizations like the World Health Organization or the UN. And you know, we are moving inexorably in the direction of, with the active support of the Biden administration, as you know, empowering these entities to be able to dictate to us what our health policies will be, what our responses to various other crises will be, including global warming and the like. Just a quick word on how ill-advised and anti-Declaration of Independence, to say nothing anti-constitutional, all that is.
Yeah, well, clearly the idea is, on the part of the Democrats anyway, that a more or less one world government, or certainly one world cooperative association, is the goal. And to allow these organizations, as you've identified them, the WHO and others, to override the sovereign institutions of the United States, Congress, state governments.
Our limited accountable government, in short. Exactly. I hate to cut you off, George, but we have to leave you. Thank you for this really important warning and your insights on so many of these issues and the great work you do at conservativehq.com. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us soon. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. His name is Tyler O'Neill. He is an intrepid author and commentator, and now I'm very pleased to say the managing editor of a terrific online resource, The Daily Signal. He is the author of a book that is directly relevant to topic A for us today, and that is Making Hate Pay: The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center, better known as the SPLC. His name is Tyler O'Neill, and he is always a welcome guest here. Tyler, we're delighted to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Hey, thanks. Glad to be here.
I'm particularly delighted to have you back because we wanted to visit with you about a topic that you have written about in the past few weeks. Entitled the kind of, well, the role that the Biden administration seems to be allowing this Southern Poverty Law Center to play in its, attacks, among others, on its political adversaries, specifically Moms for Liberty. The title addresses the comments of two United States Senate candidates from Virginia, entitled Sever Every Tentacle. Talk to us a little bit about this and some breaking news that you and your colleagues at the Daily Signal have just exposed about the ties between the Biden administration, including the President of the United States, and this notorious organization.
Yeah. So it really is shocking the way that the Biden administration has tied itself in with the Southern Poverty Law Center. And we've seen, you know, the FBI cite the SPLC in going after radical traditional Catholic hate groups at the beginning of the year. And then we actually saw an SPLC lawyer arrested at a Molotov cocktail riot and charged with domestic terrorism for his involvement there. But the big shocking thing to me was in June when the SPLC added Moms for Liberty, and a whole bunch of other parental rights organizations to the hate map. Naturally, you know, it's a weird topic for us to talk about because you've been on there for years, obviously unjustly slandered. But now they've, you know, they've really kind of opened the floodgates here. They put Eagle Forum chapters on there. They put the American Constitution Party on there, all as anti-government extremist groups. And then, of course, they put the parental rights movement. And this, you know, this set off alarm bells for me because I remember in 2021, you know, not just like 2 years ago, when the Biden administration worked with the National School Boards Association to brand concerned parents domestic terrorists. And that letter that the NSBA sent to Biden, which we later learned Biden...
The NSBA being a teachers union, as I recall?
Yes. Yeah, essentially a teachers union-like group. But they sent this letter, and they urged the Biden administration to use the Patriot Act against moms and dads who are just expressing their opinions at school board meetings.
About how their children were being taught. And right. Let me just ask you to take a pause here because I failed really to set this up properly. You're absolutely right. I have been vilified, as has my organization, the Center for Security Policy, repeatedly by the Southern Poverty Law Center. So I got a dog in this fight. But let's talk a little bit about what Making Hate Pays has demonstrated about the nature of this, I think, thoroughly discredited organization. And then we'll tie it back into the people that they are defaming now and the access and, well, the use that the Biden administration is affording these guys and using them to, again, sully, if not prosecute, people who are nothing more than political opponents.
Yeah. So in 2019, the SPLC actually fired its co-founder, Morris Dees, amid a sexual harassment and racial discrimination scandal. And then amid that scandal, a former employee came forward with this, with an article from which the title of my book comes, where he said, "We were part of the con." And he said that the SPLC's hate labeling was a highly profitable scam aimed at bilking liberals by bilking donors by exaggerating hate and by branding their political opponents to try to silence those who disagree with the SPLC.
And okay, so just to be clear, that's not you saying it. That's not me saying it. That is an employee at the time of the Southern Poverty Law Center from inside the wire. Is that right?
Yeah, former employee. And actually, this former employee also was closely involved in the case of D.A. King. He worked for the SPLC when they were covering D.A. King and the Dustin Inman Society, which is a case that now has made it to discovery. D.A. King, representing the Dustin Inman Society, which appears on the hate map, filed a lawsuit against the SPLC alleging defamation. And he has made it to the discovery process. And the involvement of that former employee, Bob Moser, plays, I think, a big role in granting his case even an even stronger heft. So this now, is
again, let me just interrupt for one more second. Yeah. The significance of this is the Southern Poverty Law Center is essentially a law firm, a public interest law firm, ostensibly, that has, I think you told me the other day, $700 million now in its endowment, and is using lawfare to attack, again, its political opponents. And so when you get to the discovery phase and you actually have the opportunity to expose what this organization is about with, you know, testimony from individuals who have previously worked for it, among others, this could be a very bad thing for these lawyers and political hatchet men and women at the Southern Poverty Law Center, no?
Yes, this could be, I mean, this could blow everything wide open. And we've already seen, you know, yeah, I know, I think it would serve the American people to have more of these documents made public to show just how you know, how little credibility this organization has. But I think that's particularly salient because Biden, you know, we just published a story about the White House logs with Biden showing that Biden personally met with SPLC staff at least six times in the past 3 years. And SPLC staff have been guests at the White House 11 times in the past 3 years. And
well, that would seem to be a smoking gun to me, especially when you tie it in with the kind of weaponization of political defamation that the administration has engaged in against, as you say, parents and, you know, law-abiding conservatives and, you know, people who happen to be on the opposite side, as we are, on their public policy positions, especially with respect to notorious outfits like the Council on American Islamic Relations. And I did want to ask you very quickly about this group as well. CARE is its acronym, and probably it's better known as that. Tell us a little bit about CARE and what the administration is doing with an outfit that is at least as notorious, if not a lot more dangerous even, than the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yeah, so CARE bills itself as the largest Muslim public interest organization in the U.S., but they got started with these very shady ties, this money from the Holy Land Foundation, which was connected to a terror funding scheme back in the early 2000s.
Actually, and convicted by federal prosecution.
Convicted. Yeah. Right, exactly. So CARE was an unindicted co-conspirator in that case. CARE always claims, and I mean, I think this is legitimate when they say that being an unindicted co-conspirator doesn't involve any finding of fact against you. But what they do have is what we have documents showing that CARE started from this shady funding outfit. And the current leader of CARE, Niyad Awad, used to be at, I think it was IAP, a Palestinian organization that had these really bad ties. So, like,
well, it's a Muslim brother. Let's put a fine point on
it. Exactly.
Niyad Awad has been, I think, throughout his career, and the Council on American Islamic Relations is a Muslim Brotherhood front associated with a terrorist group called Hamas. It also was tied in, as you say, to the Holy Land Foundation, another front doing fundraising for Hamas. I mean, these are disreputable people. And the story that you were focused on, and rightly so, is that the Biden administration has brought these guys in to help them study and research and analyze and work the problem of anti-Semitism. These are among the most, I think, virulent anti-Semites in America. And the record is pretty clear on that. You've done your own documentation of it at the Daily Signal. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time. Just a quick burst on that point, if you would, Tyler.
Yeah. So CARE opposes, you know, supports the Palestinian claims against Israel, which is extremely problematic when you consider it in light of anti-Semitism. The Biden White House, it had this weird... It didn't actually work with CARE on drafting the document, but it did partner with CARE for implementing it.
You bet they did. We're going to have you back, Tyler, to talk at greater length about this, because this is a really important story, as well as its heavy involvement with the SPLC. Thank you for what you've done, especially your terrific book, Making Hate Pay. We'll talk with you again soon. We'll be right back with more right after this.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. We recently published a response to the unrestricted warfare Chinese communists have long waged with help from captured elites in this country. It's called The Indictment, Prosecuting the Chinese Communist Party and Friends for Crimes Against America, China, and the World. Yesterday, that prosecution got underway in earnest. The latest webinar, sponsored by our Committee on the Present Danger China, featured two top experts and a former prosecutor who brought criminal charges in the court of public opinion against the world's most successful venture capitalist, Neil Shen, and his firm, Sequoia Capital. The evidence presented reveals they have betrayed our country by enabling the CCP to secure decisive leads in dozens of technologies that can dominate us commercially and defeat us militarily. Neil Shen and company have thus far successfully deployed bipartisan contributions to get away with such treachery. That must end now. This is Frank Effney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to Dr. Bradley Thayer, my friend, my colleague, my mentor in many respects, about what we must understand about the China threat. In fact, that is the title of his newest book, co-authored with Ilan Chao Han, Understanding the China Threat. I strongly commend it to all of you. Brad is, of course, in addition to a noted author, a very prolific contributor to periodical literature, including several pieces we're going to talk about with him momentarily. Before we do, Brad Thayer, it's great to have you with us. You are an important member and contributor to our Committee on the Present Danger of China, among other things, as well as the director of our China program at the Center for Security Policy. And it's always delightful to be able to catch up with you, sir. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you. We spoke earlier in the program with George Raceley a bit about the nomination of C.Q. Brown, general currently commanding the U.S. Air Force as its chief of staff, now nominated to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. George was very, very worried about this nomination. I think it fits into a larger subject that you've written powerfully about with another friend and colleague of ours, another frequent contributor to this program, another member of the Committee on the Present Danger China, Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired. You published it in American Greatness. Talk about the imperiled professionalism of our United States military, Brad.
Certainly, Frank. In World War II, in the Cold War, the U.S. military was archetypical possessing excellent civil-military relations. And that was founded on the basis of civilian leadership was in charge, but civilian leadership left the military domain to the military. And that was the civilians, of course, controlled the military. They made the big decisions with respect to grand strategy and even some strategic decisions. But there they turned it over to the military to operate within its own domain. And that was the epitome of professionalism. And we could trust the U.S. military to operate in that domain because it was not politicized. It was operating with the best interests of the country under civilian leadership. This has been under threat really since the Clinton years. This has been eroding. But with Obama and Biden, we've seen the politicization of the military, where the military domain is no longer sacrosanct, but ideologues, leftist ideologues, are forcing the military to bend, to warp to their ideological demands. So we see this in many ways. Of the debate which you just referenced concerning the chairman of the nominee for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is one instance of this, but it's a deeper problem where what we're seeing is civilian leadership under these leftist ideologues are requiring the military to bend to their ideological demands.
And we talked with George a little bit about how that's being done. It's not only with promotions like CQ Brown's, but also the, you know, insinuation of political commissars effectively into the ranks at various levels of the military for the purposes of assuring compliance on diversity, equity, and inclusion, among other things, I guess. But talk us through what this means as a practical matter. You're a serious student of national security and you've been a practitioner of it. You've worked for the great Andy Marshall in the Defense Department at Net Assessment. How does this translate into the perceived deterrent qualities to our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party, as well as our ability to defeat that enemy if need be?
This change is a profound change. It's what Samuel Huntington feared in his great book, The Soldier and the State, where he said the U.S. military should have objective civilian control. Civilians make the strategic decisions, they turn it over to the military. Huntington said the reverse of that, and which plagued the Soviet military, was subjective civilian control, where militaries operate under the Communist Party. We see this with the Soviet Union, of course, and in China today, where the People's Liberation Army operates is a tool of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, this matters because, first, it affects military effectiveness. The U.S. military, in the course of the Cold War, was able to meet its challenges. And those challenges, Frank, as you well know, were profound. The U.S. military went through the Korean War, the Cold War, the trauma of Vietnam, and it rebuilt itself after the Vietnam War to become the world's most effective military. It did that because the civilian leadership recognized the military domain, and you had excellent military officers in the U.S. Army, Don Starry, William Dupuy, who rebuilt the army after the trauma of Vietnam and the transition to the all-volunteer force. Now, could we have this effectiveness today? It's an open question. If, secondly, the effectiveness of the U.S. military is in doubt, that weakens our extended deterrence to our allies and to partners like Taiwan and India, which we face today. If the military starts to fight among itself, and it does so because it does not have the discipline required, and which we had during the Cold War, we run the risk of a military which is as bad as the People's Liberation Army. It's a politicized force and it becomes the branch of a particular party, the Democrat Party. The third reason why it matters is because it is at variance with the political principles of the United States, with our political history of civil military relations in the United States and the traditional role that the military has played, of course, being a product of the society. With these ideologues in charge, you're seeing really a decapitation of the American military. It's turning upon itself, and it is a threat to essentially the political principles that we have in the United States.
Brad, this is a fundamental transformation of the military, as we talked about with George Racing, and it is inimical to our security interests, as well as, I think, probably our domestic security as well. We'll be right back with more with Brad Thayer right after this. Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Bradley Thayer, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy and one of our most important contributors, both to this program and to the programs of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. Again, you can find the work of the committee, including Brad's many, many contributions to our webinar series at presentdangerchina.org. Brad, I'm resisting the temptation to talk to you about the subject of our most recent webinar just yesterday, in which we explored really the case against Neil Shen and Sequoia Capital, a matter that is emblematic of the capture of our elites and the contribution that they are making to the victory of our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party, over us. The subject of our indictment, you did me the enormous service of comparing it favorably to Jacques Hughes, the book famously about a moment of crisis in the French military. And I just want to say both thank you for that and so much else that you do for us, particularly in understanding the China threat. And one of the things that I want to use the limited time we have with you to discuss is the relationship, the so-called No Limits Partnership that was announced with fanfare about a year and a half ago, almost now, in Beijing by the Chinese communist dictator Xi Jinping and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. You've just written at The Messenger an important analysis of where that relationship stands at the moment and how Xi is viewing his very much junior partner in that relationship and where they might go from here.
Yes, Frank. The argument that I made is that Xi Jinping must be contemplating regime change in Russia, that is, abandoning support for Putin and essentially supporting one of his rivals within essentially his leadership or perhaps outside of it. And the argument of the piece is that Russia's performance has been so poor and that its
in Ukraine,
in the war with Ukraine, and its ability to occupy Western attention, although ongoing, is not what Xi wants. Putin also is not as amenable to Xi Jinping as Xi Jinping would want in Central Asia. So he must be contemplating, as dictators often do, whether Putin is still useful for his aims.
Talk about Central Asia. I'm not quite sure what you're referring to there in terms of Putin's compliance with Xi's desires.
Certainly. The domination of Central Asia has always been contested between Russia and China historically. In the Cold War, of course, the Soviets won that a battle for dominance, of course. Now it is, and in the post-Cold War period, the Russians were very influential, more influential than the Chinese. But now what we're witnessing is, with Belt and Road Initiative, China's economic might, China's economic influence, and increasingly political influence, as well as the moribund nature of the Russian economy and of the Russian political system, you're seeing the leaders, the dictators really in Central Asia, look to Xi Jinping rather than Russia.
The vacuum of power is being filled by the Chinese Communist Party.
By China, accelerated by the precipitous withdrawal of the United States from Afghanistan, sadly, in August of 2021, where the United States...
And China's insinuation in there with commercial deals, among other things. So Brad, you talk about regime change, and whenever that's discussed as something the United States should seek with respect to various bad actors, including Vladimir Putin, the point is made, well, be careful what you wish for. You may well get something considerably worse. Two questions occur. One is, do you think Xi Jinping actually has the capacity to reach into Russia and change the regime? And secondly, is there in fact somebody far worse in the wings, but might that suit Xi Jinping to have somebody who is both more reliably a supplicant to them, as well as somebody who will be even more ruthless than Putin has proved to be?
Frank, that's an excellent issue. Putin has shown his value to Xi Jinping, but he's not as compliant as Xi Jinping would want. He's still too much of a Russian nationalist to be acceptable to Xi Jinping. So if Xi were to withdraw support from Putin, that is, withdraw support from Russia economically, in the political support for the war, and in other measures, Putin would be without a friend in the world, right? It would only be Modi in India, and the support there is tangential. Putin needs Xi Jinping's support. I would think that the Chinese know the Russians very well, and they have really a Rolodex of Russian political figures, individuals who might stand in for Putin.
We were talking earlier in the program about elite capture in the United States. You're suggesting that they've got their hooks into people in Russia as well.
Elite capture is not a problem which plagues the West, sadly. It also plagues Russia. So there certainly would be alternative leaders. Whether that transition would be effective and whether it would not lead to disruption, of course, is another issue. But again, for Xi Jinping, instability in Russia is not necessarily a bad thing, because that secures his northern flank. It allows China to continue to advance its interests. Those are territorial interests, as well as economic interests and energy, of course, as we very well know.
Brad, this is a fascinating thought. Instability being protecting the northern flank, I guess, in the sense that to the extent that it creates divisions within Russia, they can be further exploited by the Chinese. And it seems to me absolutely inevitable that at some points in the not too distant future, the Chinese will simply assert, as part of their colonial build out, control over much of what's east of the Ural Mountains. This is a subject to which we will return with you, I hope, in the near future. Brad, so much more to talk with you about. Thank you for fitting us in today and for your insights in all of these respects. Keep up the good work at our Center for Security Policy. I know you will, and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.